This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Okay, I'm down in Mississippi with Chip. Why don't you go and introduce yourself, since we're at the Expand-A-Pan compound you have here.
Expand-A-Pan compound, that's interesting. My name's Chip Davis. I live in Mississippi Delta. Been trapping again now for the last 3 years, I guess. I got started like a lot of people in high school, and after the fur crash of the 80s, kind of got out of it, and life happened, and had some kids, and they kind of were interested in it, so we got back started a couple, 2 or 3 years ago. We started listening to Clint's radio show, Trapper Radio, and heard him mention the expanded pans that he was putting on, particularly on CDR traps then, and that just really intrigued me. We do a lot of...
It did more than intrigue you, dude. There's an $18,000 machine
sitting there. Yeah, it did. To start with, it was intriguing, and I had a friend that had a machine out there that would cut this type of stuff. And just it seems like the whole idea grew more and more. We actually made a few pans during trapping season last year that we just could spot weld on existing pans, and that just seemed like it got real busy. So we decided to go the next step and actually really manufacture a pan that was real trapper friendly to use. A guy could order them in the mail, remove. Just take a bolt, remove the existing bolt.
That's what you've done different. It's not the way I've always done it. Is just you get something, you either cut it out on a grinder, find someone with a machine, and then I would weld it. Albert would rivet it. Some guys would bolt it. But you've made it where you don't have to have anything but a screwdriver and a wrench.
That's it.
I mean, that's really cool.
Yeah, we were really proud of our design. My 17-year-old son has been really involved in the design process, and it's been a fun project. It really has.
So you're getting these made in China and Taiwan and Korea and all that, right?
Yeah. Well, the one similarity may be it is child labor involved.
Well, so. 17, okay.
So, yeah, we're making them right here in the heart of the Mississippi Delta, and we're pounding them out, and I think we got a really, really good product. I'm excited to, about getting them out there and getting them other people's hands. And you've had a few I've sent to you. We got some out with a few key people around the country. So
Jeb's gonna be carrying them at Oki.
Yep. Mr. Jeb is actually exclusively carrying them right now.
I'm calling Mr. His head's gonna get big.
He'll always be Mr. Jeb to us. He's, I love Mr. Jeb.
That's such old a, South right there.
Hey, it's literally he's such a great guy to deal with. I mean, just the nicest fellow you ever want to meet, and I can't wait to meet him in person. All of our conversation has been over the phone, but it could not have been any better.
Now, when you bought the machine, it's a plasma cutter.
That's right.
And when you first started thinking you could cut the, because I mean my pans are not pretty. I mean they're just functional, but they're not pretty. So I mean these are all uniform. When did you, from the beginning, were you wanting to have it where they bolted on, or is that something that came later?
No, that's something that came later. Like I mentioned, we had a few pans that we built last year that actually slipped over the existing pans. You didn't take the existing pans off. You slipped those over them. There's a really tight fit. We made them with tight tolerances. And you literally spot welded those onto the side of the existing pans. When we did that, we just decided to go ahead. I wanted to utilize as much space in between those jaws as we could possibly utilize. However, there's some tight, we've learned early on, there's some tolerances that have to be followed there. You can't have that thing all the way jammed up against your jaws, inside jaws of your trap, or your trap won't function properly. So we had to learn what those tolerances are. And I promise you, we built quite a few dozen already, but what on the initial stages of it, our scrap pile was probably 3 feet tall. Mm-hmm. We cut a bunch of them before we got it right. And we went through, I think Bailey and myself both, we don't care to see another screwdriver and 3/8 wrench for a while. We changed so many pans out. And not only do the tolerances have to be right around the outside jaws, but there's a lot of work involved in dodging your lever springs, your getting your legs right for the for the existing bolt, and getting all those specifications exactly right. This really was the most challenging part of manufacturing these from the get-go.
I mean, I saw your jig and how you're doing the bolt-on part, and the cool thing that what I really like about these more than anything else is your machine is going to make a consistent product. and the way that you're putting the bends on the nut and bolt is going to be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but there is an interesting thing about traps. Before we get into that, we have a ghost. If someone is new listening to Trapping Radio and they're hearing when you say we've got the pan almost to the jaw, and mm-hmm. just to go and get this out of the way, so if you're going to email me and ask me this question, we're going to go and knock this out. No, you do not get pan or toe catches because you have a big pan. I see less toe catches now than I ever did when I was running smaller pans. And in when you're sitting at home and you're thinking about it, it does make sense that you'll get toe catches. I mean, it just does. But you're taking what I think's what's happening on that is when that animal stands, and if he does hit the jaw in the pan, the trap moves out of the bed. The trap does not move a 40-pound coyote.
Mm-hmm.
It's not strong enough. So it's actually wrapping around that foot, and very rarely do I get anything below mid-pad. So I was just going to go ahead and say that before, because every time I mention big pans, I get hammered.
Right, right.
What about toe catches? You don't get them.
We didn't see any at all this trapping season, and obviously we're hobby trappers, and I like to be a hobby trapper. There's nothing wrong with a hobby trapper, but we caught quite a few animals, cats, coyotes, coons, you name it, and fox, little Danny fox. We caught several fox and those things, and we had solid catches. I'd say we averaged, what, inch and a half above the, what would you call it, ankle or whatever. I mean, it was really no difference than what I'm accustomed to seeing with standard pans, to be honest with you. I didn't see much difference at all.
From what you just said, I would recommend turning your pan tension down less, mm-hmm. like you were almost meat trap. All you want on that big trap is enough pan tension to hold up the dirt if it gets wet.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And when you start doing that, the trap is slow enough, even though people are scared of that big trap. I think an animal actually starts coming out of it before it closes on him, and that's why when you don't run pan tension, you're getting these nice paw catches
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
instead of burying them deep.
Right, right.
You know, but it's not just CDRs. You're putting them on Bridger number 3 Dogless
right,
and
right.
For Sleepy Creek Long Springs.
That's right. We've even got them on TS85s. We got a variety of traps that we're putting them on.
Well, cool deal. I mean, we talked about that today in the show. When we get into this here in a minute, it's going to be like entrepreneur central. And then, and I've been thinking about what we're going to talk about for about a year and a half. And I've really put a lot of thought into it. But, you know, being entrepreneur, because you're doing some other things with that, you know, there's no excuse for someone in America not to be able to do what something simple, not maybe not exactly what you're doing, but something like that.
Right.
I mean, the machine's expensive, but it's half as much as a car cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you make money with that, and you lose money with a car. So, I mean, they're really, if someone wants to figure something out, and I'm glad you're doing it, you
mm-hmm.
know. I know there's Alan Hoyt's making one, and there's another guy making a weld-on type mm-hmm. thing. And I'm glad y'all are doing it because I've never made them, never sold them, don't want to get into that mm-hmm. part of the business. And now I just go, hey, call Chip.
That's right.
You know, or call Jim.
Right.
Since he's going to be the distributor.
Exactly.
And a couple other things before we get into what our main topic is going to be. You trap a little bit different than a lot of people do. You're a buggy trapper. I mean... You know, because you got around Randy this year, and mm-hmm. he's, you know, fire-breathing, long-lining road trapper.
Right.
And that was just different than what you're used to.
It was. I made a trip down south, and, yeah, I said down south, and I'm in Mississippi. So I went to Louisiana and had an awesome time with Randy. We hit it off. He's a super, super guy. Got down there, and my style of trapping is just a little different than he is. Great guy. I love being around. Learned a ton while I was down there. Super, super guy. But we have just kind of developed a system here, and I primarily, not exclusively, but up until the Louisiana trip, probably trap 80% on our farm that we're sitting on here. And to do that, we also...
This is like a 10-acre farm, right?
Yeah. Real small. You can see from one side to the other. Mm-hmm. You can see from one side to the other.
But yeah, with spot and scope.
So we're on about 3,000. We're sitting on about 3,000 acres here. And that's primarily what we trap. And so we'll leave on electric buggies. That whole tool, as we've talked about earlier, has come a long ways in this development too. But the only reason it's nothing special about the electric buggies, we just happen to deer hunt too. They're just a really great tool for fit for where we are right here. I can do everything I need. I like the system for that. When we actually got to Louisiana, Randy and those guys, they were in tune, and their style of trapping is road trapping and long lining and going hard and all that. And my style of trapping is more getting on the turn roads, going down the wood lines, finding crossings, that sort of thing. It kind of made it interesting around the water down there with that buggy. But we could find crossovers on the levees and different things. And it kind of gave me a unique tool because those guys were pretty much on the roads most of the days. Some of our...
Louisiana is so dry in the wintertime.
I tell you what, boy, it was something. Mud, and then a little bit more mud on top of that. And we actually, believe it or not, had several days that we were frozen in Louisiana, central Louisiana last year. It was unbelievably cold for down there. You were tempted to take short sleeves when you went there, and we about froze to death a couple of days. So the buggy actually gave me a chance to, and some of the property owners that we were there, they were really interested in taking a few coyotes off the place. I thought that the buggy itself kind of, brought our little team together where I could kind of chase the coyotes there and keep the landowners happy. And still we were trapping everything, but they had a lot of cats. They had a bunch of otters and a pile of beavers and coons and possums and everything else. So that we got into, But it kind of opens up some other avenues that if that's your style, you can get off the road and you can get to places that you can't necessarily access with a vehicle.
You build custom boxes in the back just so you know where.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a little box. I think I mentioned that the buggies double as our deer hunting tool too, and my whole family, including my wife, bow hunts. So we split the buggy duty. It traps in the morning and it bow hunts in the afternoon. So I got a little homemade wooden box that goes in there. But every single time, my hammer's in the same spot. Every single time, my peat moss is in a bucket in the same spot. And it's my system. And that's just what we do. My lure is on one side. I know right where it's all at. All my tools are supposed to be right where they leave them, and or right where I left it last time, and it just works for me.
Now, the brand of buggy that you just spilled my tea all over me because you had to show off the power. That is a Bad Boy buggy.
That is the new Bad Boy buggy. That's the latest one. And
since when? If someone was going to,
these came out roughly a year ago.
Okay.
And they are the recoil is what they call them. They're a 72-volt system versus the 48-volt systems, which have historically been there. And when they came with that extra voltage, they really came with a nice product. This buggy with a full charge overnight, I can trap on it all day long, literally. I can trap on it, and if I forget to plug it in at lunchtime when I come in, it's no big deal. We can still deer hunt in the evening and still, take everybody where they need to be, even load up a deer if we happen to harvest one and bring it back. And, I may be a little low on power, not low on power as far as getting back, but I may be low on my battery gauge when I get back, but I'll still have a bar or two of battery left. I've not been stranded on it. It's really it works for us and our soil types on this farm. Now, in Louisiana, all the gumbo down there, I could still make it all day, but it just seemed like the gumbo was a little bit more toll on it than the sand, like this soil type
is. Is it four-wheel drive?
Yes, it's all-time four-wheel drive.
Okay. And,
right.
In price comparison, is that like a Polaris side-by-side?
Very similar price comparison. I think these retail in the around 12, 11, 5 to 12, somewhere right through that neighborhood. And I'm not exactly sure that that's current, but
what's the gas mileage on that electric bus?
Yeah, you would be amazed. The thing just hardly uses any gas at all. It's, yeah, I don't think I've filled it up since it's been new, really. I mean, it's,
So, I mean, but the I think, you know, when prices get squirrely like they're right now, I mean, you have to start looking. My answer is normally the water in a canoe.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had that machine and you could justify the cost of that machine over a 4-month season,
mm-hmm.
what we spend in gas when we're road trapping,
mm-hmm.
or even in a four-wheeler, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to have to put 5 gallons a day in my Polaris 500.
Mm-hmm.
Every day. And Albert down in Texas, I think he's going to fill up twice a day. We're covering large ground
right,
down there,
right.
But twice a day. So you're talking 10, that's $30 even on a four-wheeler.
Right, right. That over time, it absolutely adds up. There's no hiding that. It's, you know, that'll add up. And again, that's not the main reason that I trap off of electric buggy, but that is a nice side effect of that, though, mm-hmm. for sure.
I can imagine it is. Well, 2 weeks ago, I did a show, or this may be, I don't know if it'll be either two or three, depends when I put this up. And I was talking about the reality of being a professional trapper, which is going to lead us into the topic of tonight. And I was high when I did that because of the broke ribs and the narcotics and muscle relaxers. I had the feeling when I got done with that it was way more negative than I meant it to be. And I don't know if it was, you know, but I've had a lot of comments how good it was. So either people like negativity or it wasn't as negative as I thought it was going to be. But tonight I want to talk about, because you mentioned it today, where I made a distinction between a business owner and an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm going to talk about tonight to me is extremely positive. And it's one of those things that I'm personally passionate about. And it's a business model that I think someone that's got their head on their shoulders right, they're willing to learn some extra stuff that they probably don't know at the moment, and they went about trapping in a little bit different way, they could build a business model where they could probably make somewhere between $1,500 and $3,000 a day in the summer riding around showing people how to do stuff and nothing to do with trapping. And the reason I'm liking this business model more and more, because you grew up duck hunting,
mm-hmm.
and what did you tell me today about duck hunting?
I hate duck hunting anymore.
But why?
The reason is because, well, the short version of the story, when I really loved duck hunting, is before my dad passed away, and he loved duck hunting, and we did that together. After that, it didn't mean as I didn't have the passion for it as I did. So it was something that I actually was pretty good at, and I started guiding. And I started guiding a lot, full time actually, mm-hmm. during the winter time. And with anything I've found that you do for money, even though it used to be a passion, it becomes work, mm-hmm. real soon. And then at a certain point, you almost get burned out on that. And to this point, I could care less almost. I hate to say this, but if I never see another duck, and I still, you know, that's not altogether true, but the whole part about the guiding and the doing it for money and anything that you do for money eventually seems like it just gets old.
Mm-hmm. And I've done the predator control for so many years, and this is going to be hard for some people to understand. When we're down in Texas, does it really matter if this is cat number 99 or 104? It really doesn't, because I'm just tired.
Exactly.
And does it really matter if it's coyote 333 or 22 after so many years of doing that? Because it becomes a job. And, you know, and guys that are wanting to be a professional trapper, they hear that and they go, oh my gosh, you know, he didn't like trapping. Well, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
What I liked about trapping is more of the fur side, more trapping what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, and maybe not at, at time extensions where I'm away from home for 6 months and I come home and I go to North Carolina, then I come home and I go to Georgia, mm-hmm. and I come home and I go to Missouri, and I'm a truck driver that just does a little bit of stuff when I get somewhere. So over all these years, I really think a trapper would honestly be happier if he was a professional trapper, if you want to call it that, in the wintertime, mm-hmm. and do what he's always dreamed about and not kind of muddle the water. Because if I can tell you, when I was doing beaver year round and it's 99 degrees and you're getting ate up by mosquitoes and hornets and fighting water snakes and and everything else, it ain't the same.
Right.
I mean, it can turn into drudgery, really. I did a job in South Carolina that I was questioning if I ever wanted to set another beaver trap. It was so hot and miserable and just exhausting to do that. That's not what, when I sit at home and dream about trapping, that ain't it.
Right.
And over the years, I'm like, I want to go back and do the stuff when I first started and, you know, go to West Tennessee. We can't road trap anymore, but, you know, when I was long lining coon, and that to me is what trapping really should be. You know, you can do it as a business and you can make money. We're going to talk about that. But I think the business model may not be for everybody what I'm talking about. We're going to talk about this from an entrepreneur side. And part of the reason I want to do this with you, Chip, because, and all kidding aside, you're not a hobby farmer by any stretch of the imagination.
Correct.
So, and I want to be able to ask you questions. You've got your book out. You knew mm-hmm. where it was going to go that far. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you questions about cost. And the reason I want to do this, guys, is there's going to be a change in deer management, regardless if the college-educated biologist want it to happen or not. Common sense is eventually going to overtake that industry. And we're going to go through some of that here in a minute. There's two things that someone that wants to use a business model like this, and you, even if you don't want to go the route I'm telling you, start looking for different niches that aren't right and that you can figure out a better way, which we're going to get into. So, you like to trap, so you want to trap in the wintertime when you're not sweating to death, when you can sell the fur, where you can enjoy yourself a whole lot more, and you can actually physically get a break from it. Now, if you had a job that you started for yourself and it was a business, and it was a very well-paying business, so it was enough money that you didn't worry about, like you said, when you go to Louisiana, you know, you want to catch a lot of fur, but you're not going to starve if you don't catch anything.
Right.
That's the way we ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can be really big kids again about it, and we, you know, enjoy it a whole lot more. The deer industry is, and that's who I serve right now. I mean, that's my customer. And if I gave a private consultation with somebody, I'm going to ask you very clearly, who do you think your customer is and who you're going for? And very few people have any idea who that is. And I can tell you exactly who my customer is. They're very wealthy. They're very affluent. They're business owners, almost every single one of them. They have large chunks of land, and for a private person, up to normally between 18 and 3,000 acres. They have a lot of disposable income. They want to grow big deer. They love to deer hunt. They don't get to do it a whole lot because they work so much to have the money. And they want to do every single thing they can because that's their baby. That's my customer. If someone talked to me and they weren't in that group, I'm not really interested because that's not my business model. So that is my customer, guys. And that's who allows me to charge what I charge when I go do my stuff. And when you have these, the deer industry the way it is right now, they're starting to come around to trapping. They understand the need for it. They understand the lot of the studies that's been happening with it, but they're kind of being, honestly, they're being wussies about it. I mean, they're the biologists have been trained, no, you grow cover, and if you do that, your fawns won't be eaten. Well, now all these studies have proven, I don't care, when you're on the Savannah River in South Carolina, you can't see in front of you, and they're still losing 70% of their fawns. So that's obviously not true. And where I trapped in Alabama, that wasn't true. And these landowners are seeing, we're putting all this money in this land, we're paying biologists to tell us to do what they've been taught in college, which if you follow that back, guys, that was back to a time when the original guy in Texas went out and got these theories based on a time when they were using 1080 in Texas. They didn't have a coyote problem in Texas when they were poisoning everything that moved down there. So they didn't have that. But they're being taught that today. So they go out and they do what they're taught to do, which is, I'm gonna make you be like a commercial farmer like you, and then we're gonna put some cover in because we're gonna put these annual plants in, and you're gonna do this and you're gonna have the best deer in the world. But over the last 15 years, when you talk to people that spent tons and tons and tons of money, they're still losing 70% of their deer. Their cost has went through the roof, which we're going to talk about what it talks to put these food plots in. And guys, I'm telling you, there's a much better way. And you may think tonight's show didn't have anything to do with trapping, but it does. And here's where it correlates, because you can take this in a lot of different ways. The way that you make a lot of money trapping with affluent people is you have to be an expert on something. You have to learn something. And a lot of guys that's listening to this is not going to be an expert in this, but you can be, because it's not complicated what I'm going to be talking about. It's just different. If you were to have a business model where you quit thinking of yourself as a trapper and you're a wildlife manager, because if you're not keeping their coyote numbers down 70% of what the natural population is, they're losing 70% of their deer. I don't care what you plant, I don't care what you do, you're going to lose those deer. So which, if those landowners that I'm talking about that want it, they want to have the high fawn numbers, because half of them are bucks to manage them, they're going to have a trapper. If you're a trapper, guess what? You're already the expert at being a trapper. But how do you get in the realm where these guys want to listen to what you're saying? It's money. No matter what anybody says, it's always going to come back to money. And I'm going to talk about something tonight that if you are one of these guys, but this is the way an entrepreneur thinks. I see this massive hole in the dairy industry, and I can see an easy fix for it if someone would actually not listen to a college that's repeating and regurgitating this stuff from the 1940s, for goodness sake, when we don't live in the 1940s anymore. So if we don't regurgitate that and we start thinking for ourselves, we can go down a different road. And the reason I think a business model like this, even if someone picks something extremely different, but it can work, you can be the expert to the deer people when they're wanting somebody to show them how to manage their land. Because it's not that hard. You know, it's really not that hard. But that's going to give you access to the people that will pay you the really good money in the wintertime, because they already know who you are and they already trap. So, I mean, it's like double dipping. The best way to go. They're going to pay you to save them money, and then they're going to pay you to do what you wanted to do the whole time. So you go do your thing in the summer with them, and then you get to go do your thing that you want to do in the winter for yourself. Does this make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, what I'm going to talk, and everybody's heard me talk about permaculture, and guys, I'm a plant geek. You know, I love trapping, but I'm a plant geek. I like that type of stuff. But if you think this type of business model would work, and we go through some of this stuff, you'll see how obvious and common sense it is. But it's not. It's going to take people to go out and figure out ways to get in front of the right people before they listen. And then you're going to have to get somebody that you give the pitch to, then goes, let's try that on part of my farm. Because they're not going to give you the whole farm. I can tell you that right now. And then you go out and you show them the difference. As soon as you get that first client that you show that the way he's being taught to be a farmer when he's not a farmer, and you're absolutely destroying everything that they're teaching them from college, if you don't think you're going to have people calling you day and night, come to my farm and show me what you're doing, you're crazy. I mean, it is. I mean, you can see if because you're going to be saving them money. They're going to have better land. It's going to be worth a whole lot more money. And the deer population is absolutely going to explode because you're doing the food part and you're keeping them alive. Mm-hmm. And right now, the way it's done, it's not very good on the food part, and they're just letting 70% of them die. So it's kind of a mixed bag. And there's a lot of ways you can take this, and you can get really creative. Now, what I'm going to talk about, again, y'all heard me say permaculture. If that's a little too hippie for somebody, you can think of it as restoration agriculture. Or you can think of it the way that the University of Missouri talks about it. And it is, I'm actually drawing a blank right now. It's, I'll think of it in a minute. But it's planting trees inside of annual crops. And then when you go out and you do that, and you show somebody that you can put so much food on the ground for a longer period of time for less money, it's going to get your attention. Now, Chip, if you were a landowner, and I'm going to go about this a totally different way just to show somebody how an entrepreneur thinks. Okay, your family has been in big farming for a long time. Right. Now, what do you think happens if I turned into Mr. Joe and, you know, I designed, like I had a client that designed every single place in America that cooks and has a vent that catches the grease, mm-hmm. He gets a royalty off everyone in every restaurant in America. You know, he's doing very, very well.
Right.
Well, you know, this came on kind of quickly several years ago. So what's he do? He goes, gets a biologist, and he's trying to do this stuff, and it's running him ragged because he's not a farmer, mm-hmm. like you are. Well, then he's going and he's trying to figure out, and now this is nothing to do with permaculture, I'm just talking about an entrepreneur things. And then he goes and he's trying to figure out how to do the taxes on agriculture, because y'all got the craziest tax laws in agriculture I've ever seen. Like, if you go plant a tree, which you, since you don't plant trees, you may not know this, you can go plant an orchard and you can't write it off. You can go get a loan and plant the orchard and you can write it off. I mean, it's the dangest thing I've ever seen. And I've got a very good friend, which I'm not going to mention his name because he's my CPA, and he does a couple of very wealthy landowners, and he's got into the niche of taxes for people like that. But, you know, he has a trouble getting those type of people. Now, who do I run into all the time? I'm not saying I'm doing this, and I'm not saying I'm not doing this right now. But what if I asked him, what if I sent everybody your way, if you kind of trained me on what to look and ask for when I meet a new client on the way they're running their taxes so they get to keep as much of their money as possible and depreciate the farm? 20% to him is a penance. Mm-hmm. So if I get him 50 new clients a year, that's a huge revenue stream for me. And all I'm doing is thinking outside the box. We got people that don't know this world because they didn't grow up in it like you and your family did. And we're meeting them up over here, and we're kind of like the person thing. I could probably make a living off that model right there. Mm-hmm. Because it's, most people don't know you can depreciate roads. Mm-hmm. You know, really. And mm-hmm. they spend millions on mm-hmm.
improvements, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what he does. He's went mm-hmm. and he's told me, because they've had him come to some of the places, and he started going over this, and even old farmers are raising their hand going, why didn't anybody tell us that? And after a while, he just starts laughing. He goes, y'all boys need a good CPA. Well, he's got every one of them guys, you know.
Sure.
And if someone is out there in the predator control side, they're meeting these people, that's just a revenue source. Mm-hmm. But that's the way an entrepreneur thinks, if you follow kind of mm-hmm. what I'm doing. But it's not just trapping. Okay, so we're going to go to the permaculture side. And this, to me, if we can do this in an hour show, I may be surprised. Because, and this is something, you know, I'm probably telling from my voice, I get very passionate about. Because, to me, I think we would just be a better country, we'd be a better people, we'd be way more prosperous. And with the deer side, it makes so much sense if you just get it in front of people and start asking them questions. For one, I would enjoy the biologists, especially some of the smart alecks I've met, to absolutely sit there and struggle trying to figure out what to come up with an answer. And, you know, sometimes confrontation is good advertising, to think about it. So what I want to do is I want to talk to you Chip, about what are the true cost of putting in a cornfield.
Okay.
Because if I'm not mistaken, what is it, 95% or 98% of all corn that's being planted is Roundup ready? So your numbers are the same as a landowner that has deer.
That's right. Absolutely.
And just because you plant more doesn't mean anything, because it's, we're going to go by acre.
That's right. Yeah, a bag of corn is a bag of corn. And range bound, and really, really closely range bound, a bag of corn in Mississippi is a bag of corn in Nebraska, is also the same price as a bag of corn in Oregon. Do they grow corn in Oregon? I'm not sure.
You know, I don't know about that one. That is a good question. I've been through there. I've never seen cornfields.
I don't think I've seen cornfields there either. I've been through there.
But they grow something.
That's right. They actually have a lot of agriculture in Oregon. So maybe Oregon was the big point was corn is corn. And, there are certainly different varieties. Most of them nowadays, with the one exception being garden variety corns, like your sweet corns, and people that somebody just with a garden for their family, with that exception, most of the production agriculture corn is all Roundup ready.
Because if you, like I grow Silver Queen, I think that's an heirloom, but I'm not sure because I can't save the seeds. So.
Don't put Roundup on Silver Queen.
No, I'm sure not. But if I were to go put that out in the middle of woods and not have it in the beds I've got now, it probably wouldn't do very well, and it wouldn't last. You know, it would get destroyed. So, and I know, because I know so many of the biologists has told people to do that, they're using Roundup Ready. So what is the true, honest to goodness cost for an acre of corn?
All total, as we grow it in production agriculture, we deal with around and this is just direct cost budgets. This is not any money going toward land payments. It's not any money going toward any equipment costs. This is just seed, fertilizer, herbicide, insecticide, and fungicide. That's just those costs.
Y'all put fungicide with corn?
Mm-hmm. Yep, lots of times we did. And it depends on the year, but lots of times, probably at least 60% of the time, we use a fungicide on it.
Okay.
We come in at 380 an acre.
380 an acre.
Right. 380.44 actually, but.
And that see at the base of that seems like it's not that much money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean when you do it on 3,000 acres, that's a lot of money because there's zeros involved. But if a deer person seeing it and say they've got 20 acres in food plots, that would be. I should have brought my phone or calculator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, guys, this is completely off the cuff what we're going to be doing. So if I get embarrassed somewhere, that's okay. I'm learning with everybody else. That's the reason I'm with Chip. You said it was 380?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 380.44. Yeah, I can break that down, actually.
Please do.
Yeah. We're looking at, and here again, this can vary a dollar or two, but... usually plant around 30,000 plants. Cost per unit on there is $285. It comes to about $114 in seed cost. So then the fertilizer, probably the biggest money in production corn is nitrogen. We usually spend around $130-ish on there. I've got $128 in my budget. Phosphates, we're around $30 on, and potassium, we're around $40. Then you get to your herbicide complex. Typically we'll have a early spring burn down come in at around $12. We usually come back soon after emergence with another $5 a Roundup. Come back with a product called Halex or Atrazine or a combination of the two. Which I've used quite often. It's $19.25 for the Halex, and these prices are about a year old, but they're going to still be range bound and relevant. Atrazine's around a little over $5. You'll have to have some surfactant in there for around $6. Fungicide, you're looking at a total fungicide program with the airplane to apply that, because obviously you can't use ground rigs when the corn is mature and tall. You're looking around $15 for your fungicide and around $6 to apply it with Airplane.
Well, some of these numbers will be askew because you're getting paid for that many acres, but we're still going to leave that number alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, because Airplane's not coming for $15 for an acre.
Right.
I mean, there's no way that would work.
That's right.
Now, for a smaller scale farm, say one of your older tractors, what would that cost you?
Anything, and not even our big tractors like we use, but any kind of a tractor that's a little bigger than, say, a utility, like I almost call them souped-up lawnmowers. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the lawnmowers I have, they don't have what you have, but they have way bigger than the souped-up
lawnmowers. That's right. So I'm saying mid-range, you know, 130-horse tractor, you're looking around $20,000.
$20,000.
And that's well used. You did say used, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's well used.
Okay. And is that tractor going to be able to do everything they need? What about implements?
Oh, absolutely not. The tractor's where you start. So you'll need a planter for sure.
Used price of that.
Planter, you're going to spend another, let's say you get something pretty rough. And I'm thinking food plots. I'm thinking, you know, a guy's just buying this to plant food plots, not necessarily production corn. You'll be bargain shopping, but you're still going to probably spend, round it off to 15,000, 12 to 15, but you can say 15.
Because most of the clients I'm talking about, believe it or not, probably have, like David probably has an honest 300 acres in food plots.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to even go smaller just to prove a point. Okay, so you got a cedar.
Gonna need some way to spray it, to spray your burn down, to spray your early roundup on. I'm not talking about the late fungicide application, but you will have a herbicide program that you'll have to do. And so you have a sprayer. You can probably pick up a used sprayer for $4,000.
Okay. What else would you need to do then?
You would need some way to distribute your fertilizer. Now, that can be done custom, and even in production agriculture, a lot of times you'll hire that done custom. That's not in our budget because we actually do that under a fixed cost budget. That comes with my tractors and how I assign my money there. But if you had it custom done, and somebody with a food plot probably would, you can add you another, just say $10 to do that ground rig custom, and that would probably take care of your application of your fertilizer. Not fertilizer itself, but
so
somebody
that's you wouldn't need equipment for.
You wouldn't necessarily need that equipment, but it'd still be a real cost to you.
Okay. I don't know how to add that in. So what else would you need?
Okay. That's pretty much, I believe, going to get you covered right there.
Okay.
And this is no harvest equipment at all, of course. But
now, what do you think once you buy a used tractor, what do you think the honest cost is before you got to start dumping money into it or get another one? Is it 10, 12 years, 15, 20?
More like 7 to 10. And then you could expect to spend, and we just bought us a $20,000 used tractor. And that used tractor is probably going to be 15 to 18 years old for that price. You could expect to probably spend $2,500 a year on repairs on it. You're going to have hydraulic lines blow. You're going to have leaks.
How much for repairs?
At least $2,500 a year.
Okay.
And then you're going to have diesel cost with that as well.
Is that in your 380 though?
No, the diesel cost is not.
Well, you're cheating, man.
Well, some things on a large farm like this are much easier to capture your cost under fixed budgets. Although diesel fuel is certainly a direct input budget, I can look back at what I spent on my total diesel bill a year ago, and even though it's a fixed budget, it's got to be accounted for. I use it under a direct budget because I use it under a fixed budget even though it's a direct cost because I can calculate really closely. I don't know if that gallon of diesel went to service cotton or corn or soybeans or wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to assign it to a corn direct budget or it's hard to assign it to a wheat direct budget. But I can capture, what's important is capturing that cost, because that's a real cost that I've got to make enough more money to take care of that cost for. So I actually treat that under fixed cost budgets. But yes, it is absolutely an expense.
What do you think a real, just a general honest for fuel, because you're going over it when you plant it, when you herbicide it, when you do all that other stuff. So how, on the trips, what do you think that'd be per acre?
You're probably looking at, conservatively speaking, $35 an acre.
Every trip or for the whole year?
No. That should be roughly for the whole year.
Okay. So that's really not that much just for an acre. But it does add up. Okay. Per acre.
And we're looking at 3 or 4 trips across the field is all we're looking at. So, you know, if you want to break it down on a, you know, per trip, you're looking at $10. But it's kind of like I was saying about my budget. It's easier to treat that as a whole number.
Well, on 20 acres, that's $700 a diesel fuel.
Right.
Holy cow. Okay. And guys, if you tuned in for trapping, trust me, we're going to get there. But this is the way when the biggest part of the reason I want to do it the way we're doing it is some of the biggest shows that get listened to repeatedly from the same IPOs is when I'm talking about business. So when I'm looking at an idea, not that I'm always right, but this is what my brain's doing. So if your brain naturally didn't go this way, start pushing it this way. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm finding a pain point for a landowner. And this is getting painful. So it's about 20 acres, that's seven. I didn't realize I'm at $700. Okay. So what other costs would they have?
You got repairs, we've covered that. We've got diesel that takes care of the tractor. You'll have a little bit of repair from time to time on the planter. I don't know that we necessarily need to. We could put a couple of dollars an acre there. You may spend, how much do we pay for our planter? $12,000? I didn't look at the notes when we bought our imaginary planter.
$15,000.
Yeah, so let's just say, just give it $2 an acre maintenance, and that's going to be spread over several years. You may not touch it for a couple of years, and then you may do quite a bit of repairs on it for another year, but $2, and that's just a safe, real number spread out over a few years.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add up, and I want you to tell me if I'm doing something wrong, because part of the reason I'm throwing this off of you is you know more about this than me, so I don't want to make an assumption and be a fool later.
Okay. All right. And I just want to make it clear, too, is, you know, as we started this, you kind of said, hey, I'm going to ask you some questions. So I don't even know what's coming, you know, so it's not like any of this is planned at all. I still don't, you know, I'm still all ears to hear what we're thinking here, but.
Well, I mean, and this is something I guarantee with people you know that it may be something you want to be looking at. And everybody, I mean, really, this is the way it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And it's always like your friend with a GPS. Mm-hmm. What'd you say today? He got in at the right time.
Absolutely.
Because I'm telling you, and nothing against college graduated biologists, mm-hmm. but they're going to hold on to what they were told because they believe it mm-hmm. no matter what. Mm-hmm. Until they absolutely have to change. And they're still holding on to, let's plant some more grass instead of kill the cows. Mm-hmm. Because they look at the USDA studies. They have a sheep killer like Dustin, mm-hmm. like we did last week. Dustin goes out and he's got to kill that one that's killing the sheep. Well, every cow that comes across a fawn is a fawn killer. Mm-hmm. I don't care how old it is. If it can walk, it's going to kill the fawn. So it's a little bit different. So what we have to do as professional predator control guys is get their population down to 70. And everywhere I've done that, it's spiked fawn numbers. They're unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to do on that side. So what I'm doing right now is for me to plant 20 acres, which mm-hmm. is very small on the landowners I'm talking mm-hmm. about, that's $7,608.80 mm-hmm. to run that. So that number seems... Mm-hmm. Okay, now on the, and that's counting, that's not counting fuel. So let me add that in. And Cindy calls this piddling. Because I don't know unless I start running numbers. Mm-hmm. Because until you run numbers, you don't know what you're talking about.
I'm a professional piddler then, because that's all I do.
So really, to do 20 acres of corn, in modern day times, that's 8308. Okay, and that's counting the fuel. So we have this, clear this out. We've got a 2500 in repairs. We've got a $20,000 tractor plus $15,000 planter plus a $4,000 sprayer. That's not $415,000. Okay, let me try this again. 2500 plus. Yeah, why don't you do it on that machine?
Yeah.
2500 plus 20,000 plus 15,000 plus 4,000.
41,500.
Okay, 41,500. You're saying 10 years, that's $41,500.
Mm-hmm.
So let's divide that number by 10.
Okay, so you're looking at $4,150.
$4,150. Okay. So the true cost of a landowner to plant 20 acres of corn is $4,150 plus 8308. What is that?
$12,658.
That's crazy. For 20 acres of corn for deer. Okay, now entrepreneur thinking. I'm thinking, okay, I'm looking at someone that has money, that wants to grow big deer, or they want to have good deer to go hunt, or whatever their reasonings are, because they all are different. I mean, I'm amazed. So to do 20 acres, that's $12,658.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what time of year do you plant that corn?
Springtime.
Springtime.
Early spring.
Okay. When you're planting that corn, what's growing in that field?
Nothing is growing in the field.
So there's no food value in the spring.
Right, correct.
Okay, in the summertime, how much food value is in that cornfield?
Next to zero.
So you've got no food value when the mama needs food for fawns.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, interesting. Okay, when is the food value of corn?
In the fall.
In the fall. And if you were to plant 20 acres of corn, would deer in a regular population, say Mississippi, would they eat every bit of that corn?
They would munch on it hard.
They'd munch on it hard. Would you say they would eat 50%?
I would say probably more than 50%. We're talking about 20 acres of corn on average Mississippi deer population. I'm saying 80%.
80%. Okay.
We've got lots of deer in Mississippi now. We've got some pretty high populations of deer. And if we only got 20 acres of food source, they're going to eat way more than their fair share.
But there's really only... Because, see, I don't grow corn like you grow. So when it gets ripe, I pick it.
Right.
So how long? So is it 2 months it stays in the field average?
You'll start a typical year.
It's not even do that. Landowner keep it there forever because it's just for deer.
Right.
Okay. So on an average acre, because we talked about this today, what is an average? Not the bad years and not the good years, but just a really honest.
Taking care of it, fertilizing it, you're probably looking at 150 bushels an acre.
And we came up that was 5,500 pounds?
That's right. That 5,600. No, I'm sorry. 150 bushels is 56 pounds per bushel. That's 8,400 pounds per acre.
8,400. Okay. 8,400. What's that divided by 80?
Divided by 80?
80%, sorry.
I'm sorry. Was 8,400 times 0.8 is 6,720.
Can you figure out where I'm going with this yet at all? Not quite.
Okay. I'm still with it.
Okay. So But this type of thinking, guys, is got to be put to anything that you do. And so when they spend on 20 acres of corn, they're going to have that 12,000, and per acre they're going to have somewhere around 6,720 pounds of corn. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's not counting that's just the corn kernels, right?
Right. So we're on right. That's correct. That's
the
correct.
Food part.
That's the food part, exactly.
If we were to grow soybeans, mm-hmm. is the cost going to be somewhat similar?
The cost would be very similar. Accounting the same way as I accounted, just for direct cost on corn, I had $380, and my real figures are around $200 for soybeans. So that, you know, they're a little cheaper crop. They're much cheaper on the seed. Take quite a bit less fertilizer. Herbicide is still about the same. You know, fungicide and insecticide is still about the same. So you're coming in right around $200 on the biggest savings is the seed cost. We were spending $114 on corn. We're spending around $65 to plant a crop of soybeans.
Okay. Do you think, I don't see a lot of damage from corn on soybeans at home, but I may be
from
mistaken.
Deer on soybeans?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. No. Certain areas
is
here.
Is it the pods they're only eating? Because, I mean, the plants always look great till they...
Yeah, now they'll eat the foliage. Now, the difference between corn and soybeans, they'll start eating the soybeans when they emerge. And if it's a big deer population, they can completely destroy the whole entire stand. And if it's only 20 acres in a big deer population, for instance, my other farm about 30 miles from here that I work, we cannot plant soybeans next to a pine plantation. There's so many deer that they'll annihilate it.
Okay, so 20, that would be... there's a huge difference in cost to plant soybeans to corn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you're looking at the same fixed cost, 200 in direct versus, what was it, 380 in corn. So about $180.
Okay. Now here's something. Have you ever looked at the nutrition of the Roundup Ready corn compared to the corn that the numbers, when you look on the back of a can, was from the 50s? Have you ever looked at the difference?
I don't think I've ever compared that.
You ought to, because from the business model I'm talking about, I will scare the bejesus out of someone planting Roundup Ready corn for a deer. The carbohydrates are like 20%. The minerals and stuff are like 10% of what regular is. And then there's actually, the chemical in Roundup is like
glyphosate, right.
That actually is inside the corn at 30% of the kernel. When they break all that stuff down. So that's in there, but there's no nutrition. And I've talked to several people that raise hogs, and if you feed hog Roundup Ready corn, he'll starve to death because there's nothing in it anymore.
Wow.
Because they're doing that. So if they're growing corn for a deer that no longer has a nutritional value but looks like corn and tastes like mm-hmm. corn, what are they really doing?
Mm-hmm. They spend a lot of money for not a lot of good.
Right. I mean, but see, from my business model I'm getting ready to get right. into, that's big.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't found one that I can do that to soybeans with that seems like I can source like the other one. Mm-hmm. So, because a lot of people are against GMOs for a lot of different reasons, mm-hmm. and you got to be careful. So, mm-hmm. because I'm telling you, if you start doing what I'm getting ready to tell y'all guys to do, if you want to make a lot of money in the summer so you can go trap a lot in the winter, you better know what you're talking about, because a biologist will enjoy embarrassing you in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to know what you're talking about. So, you know, you just don't listen to me and Chip. You got to do your own research. So the value of that food on corn is that, but it's that much money. Now let me ask you a question. And this is the one where deer management is screwing the pooch. What does it cost you to grow that corn next year?
As far as
this crop, we're planting mm-hmm. your crop now. Well, there's cotton here, but mm-hmm. where were you? If you mm-hmm. got corn somewhere, right. This year on 20 acres, we're going to spend $12,658 on corn. After this year, what's it cost you to plant that corn next year?
It would be the $12,658. Then it would start all over. None of that carries over.
In the third year,
None of that carries over.
In the fourth year.
None of that was going to carry over.
So there's really, besides maybe, like some of the stuff we saw today, where you're laser doing the fields, mm-hmm. there's really no value to that land besides the land, because what you're doing is only...
It's an annual seasonal crop.
It's an annual crop.
Right.
Okay. So let's say someone's going to have... a place for 20 years times 12,658 to do those deer. I can't be right. I don't think your calculator works.
It may be messed up. Actually, probably had another one. I don't see it.
Sorry, guy. Like I said, this is totally off the cuff, but I want someone to understand. And I do the same thing of what I'm doing right now when I talk to a landowner that feeds feeders in Coon. Times 20 equals. So for them to have no extra value to their farm over 20 years, corn is $25,000. That's numbers I ain't even used to say it.
$253,160. Is that your number right there?
Yeah.
That's a quarter of $1,000,000.
Okay. Yeah, see, I don't only don't play that very often. So when I'm usually playing with my numbers, that ain't right. Good God, that's a lot of numbers. Okay, we got $250,000 in this. But by the time the 20 years is out, that's not a true number because he's already depreciated his tractor and had to buy another one. So that's right. Really not real. But we'll be nice to the landowner and we're going to say $250,000.
Right.
To plant something that in year 21 cost how much?
The same amount. Actually more, because seed's going up every single year. Fertilizer's going up every single year.
And then what did you tell me today that rocked my world about fertilizer? Can you say that, or are you getting in trouble for that?
I don't think so. He's going to come.
Catch me. I mean, that's like spooky stuff.
It is spooky stuff. I got a good friend that lives in the... eastern side of Tennessee that'll come to my rescue if they do. A lot of this fertilizer market, a very, very substantial part of this fertilizer is being imported from Russia. And that is scary in and of itself to me.
So if we really piss Russia off, they shut off the fertilizer, these numbers get really skewed really quick.
Yeah. Well, what you actually could do, and it absolutely would skew the numbers, your fertilizer costs would go down because you would not have any fertilizer available.
But
now your yield would go to pot. We wouldn't be talking about the little bit of income we added to that budget, the little bit of value for the deer, which was the little bit of food there, would not be there either, because instead of a yield of 150 bushels, you're looking at a 20 bushel yield with no fertilizer. And that's if you got some other source of chicken litter or some other alternative,
which that'd get very expensive.
Right, it'd be expensive as well. So
that's just something to think about when I say it's going to go there eventually, guys. And when someone loves their deer as much as they love their deer, you know, and I'm not that way about deer. Mm-hmm. To me, they're kind of like goats with horns. You know, I mean, really. It's just not something that's my thing, like
right,
a bobcat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, somewhere down the road, there's going to be interruption somewhere. And when I say get into something at the right time, if you're already setting yourself up into what we're getting ready to talk about, you will have so many customers that you will not know what to do with. But if you take these numbers that me and Chip just went over, which are honest numbers of a farm, to run 20 acres of corn over 20 years, that's $250,000. I've got a solution for a landowner that's drastically different, that's going to save him so much money. He's going to have value. He's not going to have the implement cost every single year the way, I mean, they're minor. And it just depends on how much he wants to push this. But something else that I think a landowner will know if they're going to be honest with herself, what happens if you said if you don't use fertilizer on your ground, it goes down to 20 bushels an acre?
Right. I think that would be a real number with no fertilizer.
Okay, 20 bushels. Why can I plant corn in my front yard and do very well the first year without putting any compost or anything down? Why in my yard or anybody, or I can go to the somewhere it hadn't been farmed the way that mm-hmm. you're farming, mm-hmm. why will that corn grow and actually put a decent yield on?
It is, I like to think about fertilizer like a savings account. Without putting anything in, it doesn't get any bigger. Now, the difference in your yard is nature. Okay, or the difference in a non-tilled acre, is that fair?
Yeah, back in, say, 1400. If you were to plant corn, it'd go crazy.
Right. Well, somebody's been putting money in that savings account. Nature has been building that organic matter up for years and years, and the nutrient values are there. And, you know, that nature's taking care of that for you. What I started to say is say you raised chickens, and you had a chicken coop on I actually raise chickens and just a hobby, and we eat eggs, but my chicken coop's very small. I just slide it up a footprint about every 10 days, and say I only had two rows of corn and they were right there, and I never bought a bag of commercial fertilizer. I've got fertilizer there. I still put fertilizer out. I didn't spend any money, but my chickens did, and nature did, and nature took care of that over the course of time. So I kind of think of like fertilizer like a savings account. It's got to be put in somehow or another. You know, I can put it in, or you can put it in, and you're welcome to put money in my savings account if you'd like.
Well, sure.
but if nobody puts it in, it's not there to use.
Okay. Do you think, honestly, and I'm not judging at all by this mm-hmm. conversation, and I think mm-hmm. you can tell by today, I'm not judging anything. Every year you put the fertilizer when you said that about the fungicide, it never registered, but corn's a grass and grass works off bacteria, mm-hmm. not fungus. So that makes sense to me mm-hmm. when I thought about it. So if you every year you put that in, do you think the fertility of your soil is raising or lowering?
Now, fertility is more of an area that needs to be managed. You know, you want to keep your fertilities at certainly a base level always, and that comes with being, you know, more of a good steward of your land. And, you know, in production agriculture, if we can't keep our fertilities to...
But you're doing it through the fertilizer.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm doing it through fertilizer.
So, you know how I garden.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
My dirt looks like your dirt under my grass.
Mm-hmm.
In where my food forests are, they're black as that chair you're sitting in, and
right.
I can plant a tree with my bare hands.
That right.
Fertility.
Exactly.
Is your, by planting the corn on the land, because it's, I'm going to get to the point in a minute.
Right.
Is yours ever going to turn black and you
no.
can plant a tree with your hands?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The closest we can come to that, and so maybe there is some value with high organic type crops like a corn, like a milo or grain sorghum, something like that with a lot of biomass, you can help some organic matter. But you'll never turn that soil black with commercial agriculture, and that's not really the goal of commercial agriculture either, as much as it is, you know, something with that goal. But
produce,
right. But to answer your question, you know, we're taking care. We're extremely concerned about fertility, but that when we talk about fertility, we're talking about nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, and micronutrients, and most of those we're commercially applying, you know, to keep certain chemistry levels to sustainable levels that'll, you know, that'll keep that balance where we want that balance in our savings account. To go to the next level, and I think that's what you're talking about, where it's extremely rich and this soil looks like black cow potting soil that you buy at Home Depot or somewhere, then we'll never get to that stage with what we're doing.
But as someone that grows stuff, would you like your dirt to be?
Oh, I would love for it to be like it, absolutely.
And it would be worth more money?
Absolutely.
That way?
Absolutely.
Okay, and that's kind of the point.
And it'd be worth more money because it's more productive.
Okay, we're going to stop there. We're not really going to stop. We're going to keep going. But I appreciate you being on tonight.
Okay.
Now, guys, if you have hung with us this far, I'm going to get into the second part of this. And I'm telling you, there is a crap ton of money to be made at this. So we'll see y'all next week.